Welcome to Lending Forward, a podcast where we're lending every bit of what we know to our listeners. From real conversations and lessons learned deep within the industry to education and forward thinking. Together, we're Lending Forward. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to our channels and connect with us on www.atlanticbay.com. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSConsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 203, Virginia Beach, Virginia, 23452. Welcome to another episode of Lending Forward. I'm your host, Taylor Ellard, and back behind the mic with us again is the one and only Dan Habib. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Well, last time we spoke, it was before the first of the year, and we didn't really know what was going on. We still kind of don't know what's going on as consumers, but you obviously can predict well. You guys predicted last November, back in like May or June, so you know what's going on in the industry. Tell us a little bit about kind of what we're up against right now, and where do you see things headed?
Yeah, so Tilla, that November 10th was when we thought we were going to see inflation begin to really roll over and move down. And we certainly saw a really favorable consumer price index report, which measures inflation. And that was sparking then the best bond day that we saw in the market for 2022. We saw mortgage bonds that day, boy, went up about 150 basis points, and we saw some follow through. And we saw, as a result, mortgage rates move lower. Now, we saw mortgage rates go from about 7 and change down to, at one point, they actually broke beneath 6%. They were at like 5.99, but for a very short period of time. And then what we've seen as of late is some economic data that has scared the markets and pushed rates higher. Now, does that mean that they're not going to go down again? No, we believe rates are going to move lower. I'm going to give you some important dates to keep in mind. But let's just talk a little bit first about what happened and what some of these data points were that came out that really spooked the markets. Well, the first thing we saw is the jobs report for January that came out. Now, the jobs report is one of the most important economic reports out there because it shows you a really good gauge of the health of the economy. And certainly one of the best measures of the health of how businesses are doing and the economy is doing is how many jobs are being created each month and also what the unemployment rate is. So what percentage of the labor force out there is unemployed? So when we take a look at what happened in January, well, it looked like there was a blockbuster jobs report. You know, for all of the anecdotal stuff that we've been hearing out there, where you see tech companies laying off 10, 15, 20% of their labor force, and you see a lot of signs of the economy out there slowing, well, out of nowhere, you had a jobs report that showed 517,000 jobs created in that month of January. Wow. Way better than estimates. And on top of that, to make matters worse, you saw the unemployment rate drop from 3.5%, which was already low, to 3.4%. Now, that's the lowest unemployment rate since 1969. Wow. Now, when I saw this, I said, boy, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Does this feel like the strongest labor market we have seen in, you know, 50-something years? Certainly doesn't, right? So when you dig deeper into it, and very few people know this, so you guys will be in the know, but when you dig deeper into it, there was a reason for this strong jobs report, and I think it was a bit disingenuous. And I'm going to show you some of the raw data that came out, as well as some of the adjustments that were made for things like population. So first of all, we have to understand what this is. So right now, a lot of people are starting to see that there were some big seasonal adjustments that were made. So what's a seasonal adjustment? Well, what they're trying to do is show you what the data is when you remove seasonal effects. Now, seasonal effects are quite common, and they happen all the time. For instance, if you see that there is some really strong jobs numbers that are occurring before the holidays every year, is that truly showing you strength in the economy? Or is that something that happens every year as retailers out there and different companies are preparing for the holiday shopping season? How about farmers out there, right? At harvest time, they need some more hands to help. They're going to have much more labor there. Right. Is that something that really shows you the strength in the economy? Or is that something that happens kind of just at this time every single year? Look at amusement parks and hotels and destinations, right? They're all going to be doing better in the warmer summer months given that location. So all of these things, what they try to do is they take the raw data, all these organizations that release this economic data, and they try to seasonally adjust it so we can remove some of these seasonal impacts that occur so you can see what the true trend is in the economy. Maybe a better example would be this. If you saw for 6 months in a row negative job growth, clearly it would look like the economy is not doing well. But then if all of a sudden you saw a big spike up during the holidays, is that really showing that now there's a change in that trend? Or is that just a temporary seasonal hiring there ahead of the holidays? So it has a use case and a purpose for it. However, the seasonal adjustments are all thrown out of whack. Why? Well, first of all, these organizations historically do a very poor job of seasonally adjusting. But you had COVID, which didn't only impact us in that year, but several years after that, COVID has distorted these numbers. And when you take a look, the raw number for the jobs report for the month of January, it wasn't 517,000 job creations. It actually showed 2.5 million job losses. So that means that they tried to make a seasonal adjustment, trying to account for the fact that, hey, after the holiday hiring, people usually get laid off in January because a lot of those are part-time jobs just for that holiday shopping season. Well, the seasonal adjustment was 3 million. So that's how it took you from a negative 2.5 million raw number to a positive 517,000 job creation number. Now, there was also adjustments that were made based on population controls. So how many people are actually in the U.S. and working? And they even admitted this. They adjusted the population controls where now they found a bunch of more workers, many of which they said were illegal immigrant workers, that changed the numbers as well. Now, very few people realize this, but the jobs report actually has two surveys. It has what's called the business survey, and that is where you get the headline job creation number, which was 517,000. But then you also have the household survey. It's a different method of them collecting data where they're actually calling households. And that separate survey is where you get the unemployment rate from. Well, within that survey, there's a different job creation component. And it showed not 517,000 jobs created. It showed 894,000 jobs created. However, 810,000 of them were due to these changes in the population. So really, the report, when you remove that, only showed 84,000 job creations. I think that that's probably a better number because it's tied a lot closer to what we saw from ADP, where they showed there was only 106,000 jobs created. And the ADP isn't using all this modeling like the BLS is. What they're using is 25 million actual real payrolls. So listen, here's the bottom line is that they made all these adjustments that occurred over 2022. And instead of putting them in previous months, they lumped them into January. And I think that's disingenuous because it made it look like all of a sudden we had this blockbuster job creation month for January, right, when in fact it was adjustments that they made over the course of 2022 earlier in the year. Now, I'm explaining this to you, and I think it's important to understand it, but the market's going to react to the headlines, and sure enough, that's what we saw. So because you saw all this strong jobs data, both the stock and bond markets reacted negatively. Why? Because they thought, hey, guess what this means? This means the Fed's going to interpret this as, hey, we're not doing enough to slow down the economy with our Fed rate hikes, and we're going to have to go higher for longer, right? So that was step one. Step two here is the inflation data that we saw that was the week after that from the Consumer Price Index. So the CPI, or Consumer Price Index, has two components. One of them is the headline all-in inflation number. That's important. But the more important one is the core rate. The core rate strips out food and energy prices. Now, you might say to yourself, well, you know, Dan, I spent a lot of money on food and energy prices. So why would we want to remove that? We feel that inflation. And it's true, you do. But the Fed focuses on the core because that's what they feel they can impact with their monetary policy. And I'll give you an example of why. So if all of a sudden we see all these birds get bird flu, which, by the way, we've seen, which is why the price of eggs has gone up so much. Right. The Fed can't do anything about that by hiking rates, right? If they could hike as much as they want, it's not going to slow down the costs of those going up. Same thing with, you know, things like oranges. You heard about oranges in Florida. They lost a ton of their crop due to poor weather. It causes the price of oranges to go up. Fed can't do anything about that, right? How about on oil prices? Oil prices, if OPEC decides they want to limit production of oil and all the OPEC members agree, well, less supply, what could that do? Pressure prices higher, or you can have the opposite of that occur. Fed can't impact that with their monetary policy. So the Fed likes to look at what they can control and measure so they can see if their rate hikes are having an impact on slowing down the economy. And make no mistake about it, that's what the Fed's trying to do. The Fed causes inflation, and now they're trying to destroy the demand side of the economy to slow it to bring inflation down. Now, you know, that brings us to the next question about inflation. We saw in the latest inflation data, we saw it improve on the core rate from 5.6 to 5.5%. So that did move in the right direction. However, not as much as the market estimates were hoping for. And because of that, it was not a great day in the markets. Now, does that mean that, you know, since we've had this high jobs report and this inflation report that wasn't as good as expected, and as a result, rates have moved up, does that mean we're not going to make progress? Does that mean that rates aren't going to come down? No, rates are going to come down, but we need to see more progress on inflation, and we need to see the jobs market slowing down. Well, when we talk about the jobs report, the next jobs report that we're going to be getting is going to be on March 10th. I think that's going to be a good day in the bond market and a good day for interest rates. Why? Because I believe that report, which will be for the month of February, will not have any of these adjustments in it. And I think it will show more truth as to what the health of the actual job market is. So I wouldn't be surprised if you not only see the job number potentially be negative or weak, I think you're going to see the unemployment rate shoot up and move higher. And I think that will be a good day for the bond market. Typically, the bond market likes bad news and the stock market likes good news. Although right now things are a little bit backwards because the stock market's trying to handicap what the Fed's going to do as well. Now, when we talk about the next inflation report, that's going to be March 14th when we get the February inflation data. I think that that is going to be a good day in the bond market as well for a few reasons. Number one, the way these inflation reports work is that every single month you get a new inflation reading. And if you add up the previous 12 months, you get your year over year inflation number. The latest data showed 5.5% on the core consumer price index. But what happens is this, is it's a rolling 12-month report. So when we get this number, what's happening is that we are going to be getting on March 14th, the February 2023 inflation numbers. But on the year-over-year calculation, the February 2022 numbers are replaced and they fall off of the annual calculation. So if you think about that concept, the higher the number from the previous year that we're replacing, the easier it is to see progress moving lower on the year-over-year calculation, because the chances are that the newer number coming in for 2023 is going to be lower than the higher number going out for 2022, and you could see a decline in that inflation. And you add to that that we're starting to see things slow down, and you could see how you can see the numbers come down. Well, the comparison is high from last year, number one. Number two, the biggest thing we're looking for is to see what happens with shelter costs. Why? Because shelter costs make up 43% of the core consumer price index. So that is by far the biggest component, Taylor, right? So what happened? We've been seeing progress, meaningful progress in inflation over the last several months since that November 10th report. Even in the face of this, shelter costs have been adding inflationary pressure every single month within these reports, but that doesn't jive with what we've been seeing in the real world with shelter costs. Shelter costs have decelerated. At one point, home prices were up 21% year over year. Now, according to Case-Shiller, they're only up 7.7%. At one point, rental costs, according to apartment lists, were up 18.5% year over year. Now they're only up 3.3%, right? So if you take a look at this, it doesn't make sense. Why would shelters still be adding inflationary pressure when in the real world, it's really deflationary? Well, the answer is there's a lag with the way they calculate the data. They are looking over the last 12 months, and it's almost like if you were going over like a roller coaster, where, you know how if you're going over a roller coaster, let's say you're at Great Adventure or one of those places, well, the back of the cart in the roller coaster is still going up over the hill, right? So it's still going up, but the front of the cart is going down. And then you have your inflection point in the middle. Well, right now, real shelter costs are coming down, but shelter costs within the CPI report are still adding inflationary pressure, but that will catch up. Now, I did the math on this. If the real shelter costs were reflected within the CPI report, you would actually not see 5.5% core inflation on a year-over-year basis. It would be 2% lower. It would be 3.5%. And if we were to see that happen, you would see mortgage rates dramatically decline. But it's going to take some time for that to catch up. I think March 14th, we could start to see that happen. So I want you to circle March 14th, because I think that After March 10th, which may be a good day with some weak jobs data, I think March 14th, you're going to see some lower inflation numbers, which is going to be welcome news to the market. It may even beat expectations out there. And I think you could see mortgage-backed securities rally and the mortgage rates and the 10-year yield, which, just so you know, mortgage rates come from mortgage-backed securities, not the 10-year, but they certainly are correlated to a degree. Yep. Now, the big day I want you to circle is May 10th, because at that point, I think we certainly will have the shelter costs caught up. And on a continual basis, the replacement figures from the previous year on both shelter and the core CPI are much higher. I think the economy will be in a slower position at that point as well. And here's our forecast, the bottom line. We think you're going to see in the second half of this year, 30-year fixed mortgage rates right around 5%, maybe a little lower, maybe between 4.75% and 5% if we get a little bit lucky as inflation comes down. It's not going to be a straight line. That's certainly where we think things are headed, Taylor.
I love it. So much knowledge in such a short amount of time. And I do think that people need to just hear this. I think a lot of agents right now want to be able to express what we know is happening. And I think the expectation is probably, oh, wow, well, we thought this was going to happen quicker. Well, I mean, like you said, it's still lagging. So it's going to take some time for everything to catch up. And hopefully those dates, you know, give us a little bit of insight on what you think time-wise, you know, and I know you don't have a crystal ball. We talk about this all the time, but they're not going to go down immediately. It's going to be a trickle effect. But what are we thinking as far as timeline goes? Do you think it's going to be something that's March? Because we're given some high hopes here. So March, you know, the realization might hit. May, we start to feel the impact of it.
Well, here's what I think is going to happen. You know, if we take it, there's a couple different ways you can try to forecast what's going to happen with mortgage rates. And I think it's important to look at all of them, right? So from one aspect, you look at the economic data, which the market's going to react to. But from another aspect, you can look at the charts, just like if you were trading, you know, your personal stock portfolio, right? And you can do the same thing with mortgage-backed securities. And let's face it, most of the trading is done electronically today, much of which is done by computers that have things set at certain support and resistance levels. So, you know, they can certainly play a big role. If you look at the charts, I mean, mortgage-backed securities have really been beaten down over the last few weeks, and they're at some pretty critical support levels. If you look at some of the momentum indicators like the stochastics, we won't go too deep on this, they certainly appear ripe for a bit of a reversal or at least some stabilization, right? So I think from now until the beginning of March, I don't think you're going to see much progress, maybe hopefully some little relief rally or so, but I think it's going to be somewhat sideways. But I do think that starting with March 10th, once we get that jobs data, if it's weak like I'm predicting, I think you could start to see mortgage-backed security pricing improve and rates start to come down from their current levels. Then fast forward to March 14th, and I think you're going to start to see some further progress as inflation, as we're predicting, continues to make meaningful progress lower. And I think you can start to see really within that kind of first half of March to the second half, I think you can start to see rates making some meaningful legs lower. But then April, some of the inflation data is a little funky. Some of those replacement numbers that we're going to be getting are lower figures. So I think you might not make great progress there. But then once you get to May 10th, and that's one of the days we want you to circle on your calendar, we think that that inflation data going forward for several months is going to be very favorable and move lower. And I really think that although we'll see progress, I believe, next month in March, I think really it's going to be exciting once we start to see past May and into the second half of the year. I think you'll start to see rates come down towards some of our targets that we talked about.
I love it. So there's hope yet.
Hey, listen, I know that it's tough out there, team. And Taylor, you've been doing a great job on this show and having some wonderful guests. And listen, I'm sure that this has been talked about, but I can empathize with you guys. I know it's hard out there. Volume levels are low. But listen, there's been, you know, it always seems like things will never get better, but they will. Okay, team, we have to hang in there. We have to get through, I think, a couple more months here. But I think it's more important than ever to be able to understand this stuff. So, you know, if you're not with us at MBS Highway, we'd love to have you come on board. We break this kind of stuff down every day. But I think in any relationship, trust is important, right? But especially in a sales relationship with your customer. And I can tell you the vast majority of your competitors out there, they don't know what's driving the market. So if you can have this leg up on them and you can articulate some of the things that I just talked about, listen, this isn't rocket science. I mean, if I broke this down to your customer, do you think that they would trust me? The answer is probably yes, right? Well, you can do this too. We make it easy for you at MBS Highway. where we give you something of value to say, make you the expert, and ultimately help you increase your conversion. Listen, we have a lot less at-bats in this type of market, so you got to make sure your batting average is as high as possible. And, you know, you have to put in the work, and we don't require too much of it, 5 to 7 minutes every day at MBS Highway, but then you can start sounding like that as well.
I love it. It's time to pick up the bat. We got this, 2023, right?
Yes, yes. Listen, we're optimistic, and on another call, we can kind of go through this stuff, but you know, we're not seeing housing bubble-like conditions despite what the media is saying. There's just no inventory out there. Of course, demand is depressed, but there's a ton of pent-up demand, demographic demand. We just need rates to come down a bit, right? So I think you're going to see a different second half of the year when rates hit our targets, and I think you're going to see a lot more of a competitive market. So in a counterintuitive way and in a contrarian mindset kind of way, listen, there's a reason why, you know, some of the best investors of our time were all contrarian investors, meaning they invest opposite the herd, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to, you know, be negative looking at this, the media and such, right? But the media is always negative on the housing market, right? But you want to be a buyer on the most pessimistic day and a seller on the most optimistic day. Well, it's certainly one of the more pessimistic times in our industry and in the housing market, but this is opposite conditions to what we saw in 06 and 07. 4 million homes for sale back then, 980,000 homes for sale today, right? You had wild speculation back then, driven by widely available credit, bad loans being done, fog up a mirror, completely different scenario today. You had really high vacancy rates back then. You have record lower vacancy rates today, right? You have really strong demographics as far as birth rates and demand of people forming households today versus back then. We just need the demand to come back, right? But you can't get a bubble, in my opinion, with 980,000 homes for sale, as well as the fact that of that, 352,000 are under contract, so they're not true inventory. It's really about 626,000 active listings. Now, you know, home prices, they have not come down 25-30% like some people in the media would lead you to believe. Mm-hmm. From the peak, they've come down about 3% to 3.5%, but that was in a lot of the markets that were overheated. But I think you actually could see a bit of a reacceleration with such tight inventory once activity comes back when rates come down. So the message I would be getting out there is that there's actually an opportunity out there in the housing market. You just have to see it and understand it. And, you know, you have to have a contrarian mindset.
I love it. And you have to take this downtime, skip a beat, and educate yourself. Like you just said, I mean, being able to articulate this to your agents, to your buyers is huge. So definitely listen in for more. I know Dan always brings so much knowledge. So thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Thanks again for listening to the Lending Forward podcast powered by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. Don't forget to tune in next week and make sure you subscribe to our channel. Remember, we all play a part in lending forward. So go lend something forward today.